The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, everybody, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak on this topic. The title of this talk, The Spanish Revolution and Civil War, could give one the impression that revolution and civil war are separate events. In reality, they are inextricably linked. Discussing the beginning of the Russian Revolution of 1905, the Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin said, quote, "Revolution is war. Of all the wars known in history, it is the only lawful, rightful, just, and truly great war. This war is not waged in the selfish interests of a handful of rulers and exploiters, like any and all other wars, but in the interests of the masses of the people against the tyrants, in the interests of the toiling and exploited millions upon millions against despotism and violence." The Spanish Revolution is the driving force behind the Civil War. So any understanding of the Civil War needs to begin with understanding revolution. Lenin also makes an important observation about revolution. He says, quote, "Revolution itself must not by any means be regarded as a single act, but as a series of more or less powerful outbreaks, rapidly alternating with the periods of more or less complete calm." End quote. And this is certainly the case with the Spanish Revolution. The Spanish Civil War encompasses the years 1936 to 1939. The Spanish Revolution, on the other hand, spans the full decade of the 1930s. In no other revolution can one find such a variety of political parties and organizations fighting for political influence over the country. And like any revolution, you see all the hope and promise that such events bring, the hope of establishing a new world of freedom and dignity for all. In this way, the Spanish Revolution offers a unique look at how different political ideas play out in revolution. Marxism is a science, and only by extending a Marxist analysis to Spain can we gain a clear picture of the revolution, its possibilities for success, and why it ultimately failed. Spain of the 19th and early 20th century is not a robust capitalist power like Britain, France, or Germany. In these countries, the capitalist class is able to unify the provinces under one capitalist nation state. In Spain, the capitalist class does not unify the nation. Instead, they establish their political power regionally. And this is reflective of the linguistic differences in political movements for independence that exist in Spain until today, like in Catalonia and the Basque region. The Spanish capitalist class needs a bureaucracy, the church, the army, and the civil guard, which is the police force in the countryside, to keep the nation together. Fast forward to 1930, here is the social class makeup of Spain. You have the lower middle classes, the working class, and the peasantry that number about 8 million. The well-to-do middle classes are about 2 million people, and the classes of privilege, the ruling classes, are about 1 million. On the political left, you have the mass trade union organizations of the anarchists and socialists. The anarchists are organized in the CNT and FAI unions, and these unions join to form the CNT-FAI. They are anarcho-syndicalists, meaning they have no political party outside of the union. The union itself is the revolutionary organization, and they are the largest radical force in the country. The socialists are reformists. This means that they believe in the reform of capitalism as an end in itself. The working class will gradually build its influence, take positions in the capitalist state, and establish a worker-friendly society within capitalism. They do not support a workers' revolution to build society anew. Their political party is the Socialist Party of Spain, or the PSOE, and they have a mass union membership in the UGT. And if you want to know, kind of think about this current of socialism, it's kind of like Bernie Sanders today, democratic socialism, but the difference is this mass trade union movement that is behind this political party, which is something Bernie Sanders does not have. He's trying to influence the Democratic Party. There are a number of smaller groups and organizations that come from a revolutionary Marxist tradition. There is the Communist Party of Spain, the PCE. In 1930, it only numbers in the hundreds. It is a party that follows the USSR. Stalin has already established dictatorial control over the party internationally. In 1928, in Russia, he forces peasants onto mass collective farms, killing millions to industrialize more quickly and to compete with other capitalist nations. He expels and exiles all political opponents, including Leon Trotsky. The PCE plays a minimal role in the Spanish Revolution early on, but it grows incredibly during the Civil War and really leads the counter-revolution, and we'll get to that later. There are also groups of dissident communists. They are critical of Stalinism. These are organizations that are closest to a revolutionary Marxist understanding of revolution and organization that we in the ISO talk about today. In 1930, they begin as two separate political organizations, but then merge to form the Workers' Party of Marxist Unification, or the PUM, is the acronym, and they form this right before the Civil War of 1936. So that's the political left. In the political center, you have liberal Republican parties. They are proponents of extending capitalist development of society through liberal democratic means. Our Democratic and Republican parties in the U.S., really, if you were to kind of take those parties and put them in 1930s Spain, they would fall within this umbrella. The Democrats and Republicans of our country are capitalist parties. So that just shows you how narrow the spectrum is of our political representation compared to 1930s Spain. And then, of course, so that's political left and center. On the political right, you have a spectrum of conservative parties that seek a return to traditional non-democratic forms of government. So let's go to the beginning of the revolutionary period of 1931. And this is a year of mass struggle, 1931, which ends in the winning of a democratic republic. Up until this point, Spain has been a monarchy. With the exception of a short period of time in the 1800s. Under this democratic republic, people have high expectations. They flood into unions. The CNT-FAI grows from 500,000 to 1.3 million in the period of a couple of years. And the UGT, which is the Socialist Union, grows from 250,000 about to 1.2 million. The Republican parties dominate the newly formed government, and the socialists are a minority partner in that government. They pass a constitution with some very modest reforms that will benefit working people and the peasantry. But it is not only a question of winning the passage of legislation, but of securing its implementation in society. The political forces to the right of the Republicans are completely hostile to any reform. They don't like the democratic government and actively undermine it. So the question for the left is, how do we defend the reforms that are passed? How do we win their implementation? The Republicans are consistent in their answer. Everything is compromised and negotiating with the right through the official political channels. When it comes time to crack heads, the Republicans don't unleash their police on the far right who are undermining the reform, but they employ repression against the left that is trying to defend it. And by the left here, I'm meaning the mass union membership, the UGT, the CNT-FAI, the FNTT, which is a mass agricultural workers union, the rank and file of the Socialist Party as well is included in that, and also the small revolutionary groups of the time. The Socialist Party, being the minority partner in government, doesn't tell its membership to struggle, to go on strike, to defend the reforms. The Socialist Party not only acquiesces to Republican Party calls for civility and letting the democratic process work itself out, the Socialist PSOE actually participates in the repression of the workers' strikes. In short, they act like a velvet glove on a Republican iron fist. After 2 years of this political dynamic playing out of the democratic government repressing the left, two things happen. One, people become demoralized with their government. Members of the UGT Socialist Union openly defy their leadership, and a left-wing tendency develops in the Socialist Party. The anarchists are vindicated in their lack of support for their government. They have led important struggles and strikes, and they are the main target of Republican socialist repression at this time. Number two, second important thing that happens, the demoralization of the left directly contributes to emboldening and strengthening of the far right. In 1932, there is already an attempt by the far right in the military to overthrow the democratically elected government. It fails miserably, but there is a formation of a coalition of right-wing parties called CEDA. CEDA, the CEDA, capitalizes on a demoralized left and the weak democratic government. They win big in the parliamentary elections of 1933, and the parliament is called the Cortes. Remember, this is the same year, 1933, that Hitler took power in Germany. Pressing their advantage of a parliamentary majority, CEDA fights to have representation in the government cabinet. The Republicans and Socialists want to avoid this. Finally, in October 1934, about a year later, Republican President Alcalá Zamora, he gives in, and he allows the three CEDA members to assume positions in the government. This sparks a revolutionary movement in the mining region of Asturias that foreshadows the civil war to come. Miners take over Asturias and collectivize industries. Unlike other regions in Spain, which socialists and anarchists are at odds with one another, there is incredible solidarity among socialist and anarchist unions in Asturias. The smaller organizations and unions of the Communist Party and dissident communist groups are also active. The dissident communist groups organize anti-fascist coalitions called worker alliances. These organizations are set up to build unity and opposition among all left-wing forces to fight the emboldened right. However, the Asturian insurrection, or uprising, or commune as it's referred to, ends in complete failure because the anarchists and socialist unions outside of Asturias, who command the following of the majority of workers, do not participate in solidarity strikes. The Republicans call in Francisco Franco, the future fascist leader of Spain, who brings in military forces from colonial Morocco to crush the Asturian uprising. Thousands of revolutionary miners are killed, and tens of thousands of the left are jailed. Coming out of this, the left in Spain in 1935 is repressed, but it is not defeated. The right wing feels powerful. The main Republican Party, called the Radicals, they become mired in a corruption scandal. So the right smells blood. The center kind of falls out. The right smells blood. They press their advantage to become the ruling party in the parliament. They have three ministers. They want more. But the Republican president Zamora does not concede because he's also fearful that doing so will unleash another Asturias, right? Instead, he dissolves the parliament and he calls for new elections. The elections are held in February 1936 and result in the election of the left-wing Popular Front government. The Popular Front government is an umbrella coalition of parties of the political center and left. Even though the cabinet that is appointed is fully Republican, it begins to rule with the consent of all parties and organizations on the left with varying degrees of enthusiasm. The Popular Front is nothing new. We have seen this before in the Republican Socialist Coalition government of 1931. The difference is that the revolutionary movement of the Spanish workers and peasants has developed greatly and is about to be dialed up. And just to give you a sense for how much the Republicans were not an opposition party to the far right, when the votes are coming in supporting the Popular Front, the far right, which includes monarchists and Francisco Franco himself, they approach the Republican interim prime minister of the Cortes, Portela Valladares, and they say, "Why don't you declare martial law?" Valladares responds, "I'll sleep on it." And I'm getting too old for this. Valladares speaks with Zamora about declaring martial law, but Zamora, he rejects this idea outright. Again, he's in a situation of polarization. Am I going to be collapsed by the right or the left? I'm stuck in between. Valladares resigns. He's like, "Okay, screw it. I'm not leading this anymore. You're responsible. I'm out," right? Zamora then appoints a man, Miguel Maura, who organizes the all-Republican cabinet. So this is the situation. Following the election of the Popular Front, the right is furious. The electoral road to power that Hitler took in Germany does not happen in Spain. Large sections of the right now conclude there is no other way to power than to overthrow the government. generals begin to plot immediately after the elections. The fascist right organized, the explicitly fascist right, these are armed gangs of thugs in the streets. They're organized in a party called the Falange. They do not command a mass following in the streets, but from February to July 1936, as military plots are being hatched, the Falange is involved in provoking the left with gunfights, bombings, there are assassinations that happen. Workers' and peasants' struggles during this time begin to pick up. A virtual general strike wave takes place throughout Spain. Zamora, really sensing his position is very vulnerable, he resigns too. Right? Maura takes over, so he's the prime minister, now he's the president. And only a spark, in this situation, only a spark is needed to set Spain ablaze in revolutionary ferment. And that event that does this is the assassination of the famous monarchist and CETA leader, Calvo Sotelo. The revolution and civil war now. This is where we are, 1936. On July 16th, Francisco Franco leads the generals and the Spanish military to launch an uprising to overthrow the Popular Front government. Franco brings in the Spanish, from Spanish Morocco, Franco brings forces from Spanish Morocco, and Emilio Mola, he leads a rebellion in the north. In the cities, the uprising relies on sympathetic officers in the police barracks. The left and the radical left, in response, lay siege to the police barracks in urban centers. In Catalonia, by far the most radical region, the police melted into the revolutionary movement and all arms were distributed to the people. Where the movement is the weakest, the nationalists, which I'm going to now refer to as the fascists, are able to get a foothold. Historian Pierre Bruyer summarizes thus, okay, quote, "The key to the outcome of the early fighting lay less in the actions of the fascists than in the reactions of the workers, parties, and unions, and their capacity to organize themselves militarily. In short, in their political outlook. In effect, each time that the workers' organizations allowed themselves to be paralyzed by their anxiety to respect Republican legality, and each time their leaders were satisfied with what was said by the officers, the latter prevailed, the officers prevailed. On the other hand, the fascist uprising was repulsed whenever the workers had time to arm and whenever they set about the destruction of the army as such, independently of their leaders' positions or the attitude of legitimate public authorities. While workers are seizing arms, what are the Republicans doing? Not arming the workers. They're worried that the arms are going to go against them. They are afraid to do this, right? They're afraid to arm the workers. Martínez Barrio, who is now the prime minister of Spain, he's talking with the fascists. He's actually on the phone with the fascists, and he proposes, he calls General Mola in the north, the leader of the fascist uprising there, proposing a truce and deal. He says, lay down your arms to Mola, and the Republican side will accept blame for everything that has happened up until this point, and I'll give you a position in the cabinet as the head of Ministry of War. Mola responds, and Mola's response is interesting. Let's look at this. He says, quote, "What you propose is now impossible. The streets in Pamplona, which is in northern Spain, are filled with requetes. Requetes are right-wing militia. From my balcony, all I can see are their red berets. Everyone is preparing to fight. If I were to tell these men that I had reached an agreement with you, my head would be the first to roll. And the same would happen to you in Madrid. Neither of us can now control our masses." On July 20th, we see a country divided into two regions, one under fascist control and the other under the Republican-led Popular Front. And they're also referred to as the Loyalists, but I'm going to refer to it as Republican Popular Front. The fascists held the northern agricultural regions from Galicia to Aragon and two southern urban centers, Sevilla and Granada. So the fascist territory consists of two unconnected regions that are predominantly agricultural, one in the south and one in the north. The Popular Front controls all the major industrial and urban areas of Spain, Madrid, Valencia, Barcelona, as well as the industrial and mining regions of the Basque region and Asturias. Even though the fascists hold the Strait of Gibraltar, which is between Spanish Morocco and southern Spain, the Popular Front commands the support of the Navy and are able to assault the fascists from the Mediterranean. The position of the Republican-led Popular Front is very favorable at this time. The right-wing uprising provokes a mass movement among workers and peasants to squash the fascist uprising. But this movement is revolutionary and develops into a movement to collectivize agriculture and industry throughout Spain. The workers and peasants seize economic power locally through land and industry collectivization, and they set up political institutions of authority to defend their control. These political bodies are varied and involve a variety of functions. Some are called anti-fascist committees, and these are the most famous in Aragon and Catalonia, popular committees, war and defense committees, executive and revolutionary committees, committees of public safety. The leadership of these revolutionary committees are composed of the anarchist CNTFAI, the PSOE, the UGT, the Communist Party, and the dissident communist group, the PUM. The political composition of the leadership of these bodies varies from place to place. In some areas, there's a little bit more local control over the recall of leaders, like if they're not, vote them out. But in many places, not so much. In some areas, the UGT or the Communist Party has more influence. And in other areas, the CNTFAI and the much smaller PUM had more political influence. So we have a situation of dual power, what we call dual power, two powers happening. On the one hand, you have the working class and peasantry that have political control of the economy in the Republican zone on a very local and decentralized basis. On the other hand, the other side is there is a liberal capitalist government of the Popular Front that has really no effective political control. It bides its time. It hangs in the shadows. If the revolution of Spain were happening right now in this room, they'd blend into the wall and they have their daggers out ready to attack when the position is favorable. Then, of course, there are the fascists who, having failed the electoral road to power and having failed to produce a coup in their uprising, are trying to take power through initiating a civil war in Spain. This is the situation in July and August of 1936. The revolutionary mood and movement stays alive for months. In December 1936, George Orwell, the author of 1984, witnesses workers' power when he arrives in Catalonia and he joins a PUM militia. He says, quote, "It was the first time I had ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers and was draped with red flags or with the red and black flag of the anarchists. Every shop and cafe had the inscription saying that it had been collectivized." Sorry. So how do we go from this situation in the summer of 1936 to the defeat of 1939? To explain the defeat, many focus exclusively on the lack of arms on the Republican side to match the fascists. And this is very true. The fascists do not receive support from Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. They put, explanations to gloss over the real political limitations of the left-wing parties and unions during this time, they focus exclusively, the problem with the arms argument that we weren't armed enough, focuses exclusively on the technical execution of the war, and this is a real limitation. Okay? Keep in mind, the movement for liberating Spain was set in motion as early as 1930. The revolution becomes full-blown in 1936 and is only defeated finally in 1939. This is a long period of time. Any analysis of the defeat needs to look at the political weaknesses of the revolution that led to its defeat, military defeat, in the Civil War. The two key political questions that the left need to answer. What is the relationship between war and revolution? Do we take state power? What would that look like? Joining the Popular Front is ultimately the political answer for these groups. And this answer will prove inadequate. Let's look at these two questions in detail, starting with the question of state power. The Popular Front government needs legitimacy. The Republicans need to keep the revolutionary movement of July and August in check. To do this, they appoint Largo Caballero, and a government is formed on September 4th. And Largo Caballero is a very interesting figure. I think we need to talk more about Largo Caballero when we talk about the Spanish Civil War, because he was the leader of the UGT. He was part of repressing anarchists. He was part of the state. But then after the Asturias uprising, he's saying, workers need to take the revolutionary seizure of power. We need to form a revolutionary party. He's saying all the, he's like moving to the opposite direction. First he was part of the government repressing anarchists. Now he's like swings wildly to the left and, you know, is saying this stuff. But it's an adaptation to the revolutionary movement below. That's what he's adapting to. So we got to keep that in mind. So in Catalonia, Luis Companys, he's the left Republican leader. He plays a similar role to Caballero, left-wing leader. In July, Companys admits he has no control and that the anarchists call the shots. He says, quote, "Today you are the masters of the city and of Catalonia because you alone have vanquished the fascist leaders. You have conquered and all is in your power. If you do not need or want me as president, tell me now. And I shall become another soldier in the anti-fascist fight. If, on the contrary, you believe me when I say that I would not abandon this post to victorious fascism only as a corpse, perhaps with my party comrades and my prestige, I can serve you." And this is the way he kind of gets back in, right? Revolutionaries in the broader left face a choice. Workers either take state power or don't. In Spain, this means that they can either build the capacity of the revolutionary committees, which hold real economic and political power, to become the ruling power throughout Spain, which would require overthrowing the central government in Madrid, or participate in the organs of the capitalist Popular Front government. The lesson that Marx and Engels learned in the Paris Commune of 1871 was that you can't enter the capitalist state and lay hold of it. And the capitalist state must be smashed, and not only smashed, but replaced with a revolutionary worker state. But the political parties and organizations in Spain do not apply this lesson. The capitalist and communist parties support winning political power through the capitalist state and don't support the revolutionary committees. The anarchists and dissident communist PUM try to do two things that are contradictory. They collaborate with the Popular Front government in Madrid and Catalonia, and they try to consolidate the gains that they have made in the local revolutionary committees. Both the central government in Madrid and the Generalitat, with the government in Catalonia, seek to legalize the revolution in order to limit its depth and scope. And they do this ultimately with the consent and participation of the parties and organizations on the revolutionary left, the CNTFAI and the PUM. On September 26th, an autonomous government in Catalonia is formed, and again, this is the Generalitat. The anarchists in PUM agree to join this government. In Catalonia, in October, the historian Pelai Pages, I'm not pronouncing his name correctly, he's Catalonian, explains, quote, "By participating in government, the revolutionary forces implicitly recognized and legitimized republican institutions in Catalonia and renounced the bodies that since the July days had challenged the authority of those institutions," end quote. And he goes on to explain how the local revolutionary militia committees, which hold effective power, are dissolved over city government bodies that follow a municipal model. And these city governments are more top-down, they are capitalist institutions of government at the local level, and they give disproportionate representation to more conservative and centrist forces in the revolution. On November 4th, anarchists from the CNT joined the central government as ministers. CNT anarchist Diego Abad de Santillan justifies joining the government. He says, quote, and this is an anarchist who doesn't believe in taking state power. He says, "The state is no longer oppressive and social class divisions no longer are expressed in the state. The state has become more inclusive and fighting fascists has changed circumstances." So the state no longer exists. This is an anarchist saying this. In the end, the revolution slows and weakens, and as Trotsky wrote back in April, the Popular Front acts as a gigantic break on the revolutionary movement, and the most revolutionary groups in Catalonia, the CNTFAI and the PUM, instead of having strengthened their political position, they've become more isolated and weakened. By March, the PUM is removed from positions in the Generalitat cabinet, and the CNT, despite this, the CNT continues to work in it, okay? So I'm going to go over two questions. I am running low on time, and this is really unfortunate because I timed this, and I'm running out of time. But the question of the war is important. Following the fascist uprising in July, sailors loyal to the Popular Front remain off the coast of Morocco, blocking reinforcements from Morocco to the fascist south. The socialist leaders, like Caballero, they tell the sailors, back off. Why? They don't want to offend the British and French who have colonial interests in Morocco. Caballero refuses to support Moroccan independence leader Abdelkrim, who is exiled in France. He actively seeks Caballero's assistance to return to Morocco and build an independence movement to undermine Franco's base in Morocco. Caballero refuses this. Again, Caballero instead wants to appease the imperial interests of the British and French, and the British and French want to appease Nazi Germany. To avoid a war? How did that turn out? This is the politic of utter defeat. This is the historical neglect on the part of the Socialist Party to support Moroccan independence that contributed to the use of Moroccan forces against the revolution, first in Asturias and in southern Spain in 1936. In similar fashion, the anarchists overlook the importance of the Moroccan anti-colonial struggle. Felix Mauro, who's an American Trotskyist, and he participated in the Spanish Revolution, he was there and witnessed it, talks about a conversation he has with a CNT member. The CNT member says to Mauro, quote, "You Trotskyists are worse utopians than we ever were. Morocco is in the hands of Franco and is ruled with an iron hand. Our declaration for independence of Morocco would have no effect." Mauro's response is really great. He explains the significance of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation as crucial to turning the former black slaves against the Confederacy. Doing so greatly undermined the military strength of the Confederacy when it still held control over all of the South. The Communist Party, I just will briefly say, is counter-revolutionary from the start. Basically, Stalin's playing the game. I don't want to offend the British and French either. It's a democratic revolution. I don't want to offend them because I want to actually get them. It's kind of contrary. He is like, I want to get them in a war against Hitler, so I'm going to appease them because I want to make friends with them so we go against Hitler. So they go against Hitler, and you know, together. And then France and Britain from the other side are saying, shit, we need an alliance with Hitler against Bolshevism or, you know, Stalinism. We don't want them to move left. So you've got the, you know, both sides playing this liberal democratic game of supporting, you know, counter-revolutionary. So I can't go into that. I want to go into other things. I did want to say that the Revolutionary War poses other questions. How do you organize the army? Even the anarchists, known as being against all authority, they recognize that in a Revolutionary War, discipline needed to be established. And one of the most famous anarchists, Buenaventura Durruti, there's a great, Durruti is a great anecdote somebody wrote about him. He's in a car, he sees two anarchist militiamen fleeing the front. He leaps out of his car brandishing a revolver and tells them to get up against the wall. And a militiaman approaches him, hey, do you have any shoes? I'm shoeless, I need shoes. He's like, you can take any pair that you want here. It's better than that, than they rot in the soil. Now, Durruti did not end up shooting his comrades, but he was proving a point. We need to establish discipline. This is a war against fascism. So there's a need for centralized authority to execute the war. The question is not that the revolution is facing is not that should it be centralized under coordinated military operations, but under what authority are they centralized? Are they going to be centralized under a workers' government or a popular front government? The socialists and communists support centralizing military authority under the Popular Front government, and the anarchists who do not support workers taking state power have no recourse but to acquiesce to the centralization of military operations under Popular Front authority. In Catalonia, this process is more drawn out due to the anarchist rank and file justified rejection of implementing these measures. The Generalitat legislates in favor of a traditional army as early as October and November, but the anarchist and PUM-led revolutionary committees and militias, they're able to retain local power until the spring of 1937. But the bending of anarchist principles to centralized military authority under the Popular Front goes so far that García Oliver, an anarchist purist early on, says that enlisted men should cease being comrades of commanding officers and, quote, become the cogwheels of our military machine. I'm running out of time. I do want to say Orwell's quote that I quoted earlier. He has an anecdote where he comes back from the front. He's fought in the, you know, with a revolutionary militia, gets there in December, he's fighting for a few months, he's shot in the throat, actually, amazingly does not die. And then comes back in April, and this is what he says, and this ties revolution and war together. He says, quote, "The revolutionary atmosphere had vanished." This is April. "In December, to me, fresh from England, it was liker to a worker city than anything I had conceived possible. Now the tide had rolled back. Once again, it was an ordinary city with no outward sign of working class predominance. And then he goes on to note the changes that demonstrate this connection between the war and revolution. He says, there were two facts that were keynote of all else. One was that the people, the civilian population, had lost much of their interest in the war. And the other was that the normal division of society into rich and poor, upper class and lower class, was reasserting itself. As the counter-revolution occurs within Spain and Catalonia, the war is being lost. I don't have time to go into it. The revolution is ultimately defeated in the May movement of 1937. Anarchists and the PUM, they come out in defense of the telephone exchange, which basically was like they had in control like telecommunications, modern telecommunications of today. You couldn't send a text message without it being intercepted by the anarchists. So they could monitor all plots against the revolution. Huge fulcrum of power in Barcelona, very, very important. They go out to defend it. The communists and the Republicans come to take it. They're testing their power. They come to take the fulcrum of power from the anarchists. The anarchists come out and defend it. The PUM comes out and defend it. But ultimately, they reach an agreement with Companys, the left Republican leader. Okay, now's not the time. But this is devastating. There's not another opportunity for the revolutionary movement. André Onin, he's the leader of the PUM. He's abducted by the Communist Party. He's tortured and killed. Huge defeat. The anarchists still, for the next couple years, are participating in both governments, even at this time. Again, not all anarchists disagree. I'm just going to wrap up on this. I want to say Trotsky has a lot to say on this that I'm really, really interested in, but I'll wrap up on this. What are the components of what a successful revolutionary organization would look like? Todd Cretian has a great talk a couple years ago. I recommend people to look it up on wearemany.org. It's how the Bolsheviks became a revolutionary party, 1903 to 1917. And he says there are three components to what makes up a revolutionary organization. One, a commitment to working class self-emancipation. Two, the need for a revolutionary organization that organized the most revolutionary elements of the working class into a party that can influence and lead the class as a whole. And three, a commitment to theoretical, strategic, and tactical discussion, debate, and engagement in practical struggle so that the bigger struggles of tomorrow, which are being born out of today, we are not that we are organized enough to make the case that the working class can take state power and run society in its own interests, which are the interests of the vast majority of society. Just to say, the socialists and communists, they don't agree with number one. They have a political party, but they don't agree with the self-emancipation of the working class. The anarchists, they agree with number one. They agree with the self-emancipation of the working class, but they don't agree with a revolutionary organization that's gonna guide and lead the revolution to victory. And the PUM, they agree with the first two elements, but they don't have the time. It takes decades of struggle to cohere a coherent revolutionary leadership into a party. So I'll just say, and this will be the last thing that I say, today we have an opening of socialism. Socialism is now back. And we're in a period where there aren't fixed political positions like there were back then. There's a contradiction there though too. Back then you have more organization and you're fighting in big battles. Today the big battles will come and we have a lot of people who want to talk about ideas, but we don't necessarily have the big organizations to do that. But it's really important because Spain was the last defeat. This was the defeat that took socialism out of the working class movement internationally. 80 years later, we're still paying the price of that. And so Spain is critically important to understand and talk about more and more because it has implications for shaping the politics that are going to lead a working class revolution worldwide.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.